Your Honors, may it please the court. Both the defendants and the district court are mistaken about what this case is about. It is not about the denial of drugs to Medicaid recipients. It is about whether the defendants violated the recipients' procedural rights by failing to give them notice of the denial of the drugs, the reason for the denial, and the right to a hearing. The denial of the drugs is relevant only so that because the plaintiffs must show that they have a concrete interest in defendants' procedural violations and later in the case to support plaintiffs' claim on the merits that due process, the Medicaid Act, and District of Columbia law require notice and a hearing. We submit that the undisputed facts, and the facts, of course, have to be taken on the basis of the complaint as true, the undisputed facts in this case establish injury in fact. Plaintiffs were denied their procedural rights. It is undisputed
that you're seeking injunctive relief, so you're seeking future relief, which means you need to allege future injury, and I didn't see in the complaint any such allegation.
Well, there is not a specific, Your Honor is correct, there is not a specific statement about future injury. I think it can be easily.
Isn't that essential to a claim of this nature in order to get standing under cases like Los Angeles versus Lyons?
Los Angeles versus Lyons, of course, went to the imminence requirement. Mm-hmm. And in a procedural case, Judge Scalia said in Lujan versus Defenders of Wildlife that that requirement was relaxed in terms of procedural violations. And so even if we were anything like the facts in Lyons, where it would be extremely unlikely, the Supreme Court said, that somebody would be, they would come up to the plaintiff in the future and impose a chokehold on him in arresting him. In this case, what we have, and the facts I think are very implicit that there will be future violations.
Well, how do we know that? I mean, there have been a few prescription delays in getting prescriptions refilled that might be because the doctors were slow or the pharmacy had a computer error. There's no allegation that that will occur again. It seems very similar to the kind of thing going on whenever you're talking about random, unauthorized official conduct. You can't just allege that happened before. You have to allege that there's a likelihood that's going to happen again.
Your Honor,
if
there's a deficiency, then what this court should do is to remand to give us the opportunity to simply add that sentence. We think it's inherent very clearly in the allegations. The allegations say that in a period up to 2 months before the complaint was filed, the plaintiffs were not denied drugs. The plaintiffs all have time. Virtually every one of them has.
Now, on a related note, how would the relief work here? What order are you looking for from this court? This court orders the District of Columbia to do what?
Your Honor, I'd like to answer your first question.
You can do both, yeah.
And then I'll get to you the second. All these plaintiffs had chronic illnesses, asthma, diabetes, things like this, that it is virtually certain that they're going to have drugs in the future. The allegation of the complaint, which has to be taken as true, is that the Medicaid denies to beneficiaries in the District of Columbia up to 50% of the prescriptions that they present in a pharmacy. So the likelihood that this is going to occur in the future, I would submit, Your Honor, is virtually 100%.
Okay.
Now, let me get to redressability, which is
one thing. Can I do a follow-up to that
before
we get to yours? Is that okay?
Yes.
If we were to take you up on your offer for a remand, what would you add to the complaint? What other allegation would you make other than that you're seeking future relief? Are there more facts you would be able to add?
Well, the facts on imminence would be, as Judge Kavanaugh has suggested, there is not an explicit statement that says that these events will occur in the future.
But adding that statement, are there any more facts you would add to support it?
I can't think of any, Your Honor, because I think on the other subjects, injury in fact, traceability. Right. I think the facts are fully stated in the complaint. Okay. And so I don't believe there's anything else needed.
All right. Go ahead and deal with Judge Kavanaugh's second question.
Okay, Your Honor.
What would the order to the District of Columbia look like? What I'm teasing out with this question, obviously, is just the causation and redressability issues.
First of all, let me say as a background, again, Lujan, Justice Scalia says that in procedural rights cases, redressability is relaxed, mm-hmm. that procedural rights are special. They're not the same kind of case that normally comes before the courts in standing cases. But the order would be very simple. The order would say either the District of Columbia itself has to give a written notice, giving then stating the reason that there was a denial, the reason for the denial, the legal basis for the denial, and the right to a hearing with the procedures on what the beneficiary has to go through in order to get a hearing. Or it would have to tell the pharmacy that it was going to do it. Or ACS, which is of course the contractor of the district and is the actual one, Your Honor, I think is quite important. The denial of the drug is not done by the pharmacy. The denial of the drug is done by ACS, which is a contractor of the District of Columbia. It tells the pharmacy this beneficiary is not covered for this drug, and the pharmacy simply relays that to the beneficiary and says, I'm not giving you the drug because I've been told by ACS you're not entitled to the drug.
Does when the ACS gets its notification by computer, does that notification tell the pharmacist the reason, or does it just say not eligible?
It says not eligible. Also,
there's a code, right?
It has a code.
What's that?
Excuse me, Your Honor.
What's the code?
What is the code?
Yeah.
It's a number that then correlates to in a very brief form, to some kind of a reason.
I see. So the code is code for the reason for denial.
Yeah. That's correct. But no piece of paper is given to the to the beneficiary. There's nothing in the District of Columbia's policies to require a written notice, and they're not given. There's nothing in the District of Columbia's policies that even tells the pharmacy it has to orally tell the beneficiary why there was a denial. All the pharmacy has to do is just say deny. Now, in many of our cases, as the complaint indicates, a reason was given by the pharmacy, but that's the pharmacy's generosity or being frank about it. So there's nothing in the policies to really communicate anything other than you're not getting the drug.
Is there anything, going back to Judge Kavanaugh's question about relief, is there anything you want that isn't already essentially required in the D.C.'s regulations? D.C.'s regulations, as I understand it, require notice, opportunity for hearing, right? Don't they?
Your Honor, what are the things we want enforced? The D.C. ordinance would be fully satisfy us. They just don't do it. It's not their policy to carry out their own law. I'd like to reserve the rest of my...
I just have one more question.
Sure, Your Honor.
A technical question about one of the drugs, or one of the medications for, I think it was Doe. Is it Prevacid? Is that how you pronounce it? Prevacid? He was... This is the drug where the pharmacy substituted one medication for another?
Yes, Your Honor.
You know which one I'm referring to?
I know that there was a drug like...
I know I may be asking you to go beyond the record, but was that because the drug he wanted was not on the Medicaid preferred list? Or was there, in other words, was there some Medicaid-driven reason for that substitution?
As best as the record shows, and the best I know, that was not the reason. But I
what was not the reason?
I don't want to say to Your Honor that I am 100% certain.
Okay, fine, that's fair.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning, and may it please the Court, Richard Love for the District of Columbia appellees. Here, plaintiffs do not complain of a real and immediate threat of repeated procedural injury. And it is not substantially probable that the asserted procedural violation caused the temporary denial of the medication or that these denials were fairly traceable to defendant's actions. And it's not reasonable, I submit, to infer that providing the notice plaintiffs seek is likely to redress minor temporary delays in receiving prescribed drugs.
Before we get into the details of that, I'm just curious, is there some technical reason why this couldn't be done? I mean, it is in, you agree that everything they want is in the DC, it's in the Medicare statute and in the DC statute, right? That people be given notice of the reason.
Yes.
So what's the, is there some complex computer reason why this can't be done?
Well,
I'm just curious about the problem. What's going on here?
Okay. One, I do know, Your Honor, you referred to codes. I know there are like 99, what I was explained, there were 99 different codes. And in addition to the number of codes and the number of times, I think there was some representation that on, thousands of medications are submitted every day. And there's also the complications. I think Mr. Rucker's complaint, for example, Mr. Rucker comes to the pharmacy with a Medicaid card and an ID number, and I would submit the clear inference is that the pharmacy entered either the name wrong or the identification number wrong, and he calls Medicaid's toll-free helpline, huh? DC Medicaid, and DC Medicaid says to Mr. Rucker, no, the pharmacy made a mistake. You're eligible. Right. He goes back to the pharmacy. The pharmacy says, mm-hmm. Yeah, we're having a problem with our computer. It was resolved in a few days. Right.
What about Mr. Doe?
Yeah, Mr. Doe's certainly a more complicated set right. of,
you
set
only
of
need
facts.
You only need one plaintiff withstanding.
Absolutely.
Okay,
I agree.
What about Mr. Doe?
Well, again, if we're getting back into the reasons, we would submit, particularly, for example, no immediate threat of repeated injury for Mr. Doe, is that his own complaint says that his problems with regard to his asthma medication were resolved in February 2010, and he's been consistently receiving that medication.
But prior to that time, a year earlier, March 2009,
yes.
They had exact same problem. They fixed it. Right, but now there's new problems, right?
No, I would submit some yeah. February 2010.
Now there's a prior authorization problem now, right? But he never got notice of that.
No, there's not a prior authorization problem that has caused the deprivation of the prescribed drugs since February 2010. I mean, the problem here, this is plaintiff's complaint. It's a very detailed complaint. It's clearly a well-thought-out complaint. But each of their medication problems, I would submit, have been resolved. There's no continuing problem that is complained about.
Well, I think maybe this is what Judge Tatel has in mind, where it says in the complaint, J24, paragraph 65, that in February 2010, the problem was fixed, as you, the one to which you referred. It says in the next paragraph, in December 2009, so just before the solution to that problem,
yes.
The pharmacy orally informed Doe's mother that Medicaid would no longer cover refills of the inhalers without a prior authorization for each refill requested.
Yes.
So, and then it goes on to say that they would refill, they would not do it without a prior authorization. Until December, they would have done that. So now the prior authorization requirement is a cause of denials, right?
No. I think that's the point. Yes, in December 2009, as I read the complaint, the pharmacy told him that Medicaid now required a prior approval authorization for each refill, as opposed to the practice before. But that did not result in a deprivation of the asthma medication. They indicate, as you said, in February 2010, he consistently started receiving that medication. What it resulted in, and what I understand the complaint to be saying, is it caused great anxiety for Doe's mother, because now she had to ensure that in a sufficient time prior to the refill, She contacted the doctors and made sure that all those prior authorizations were satisfied. But she does not complain that the medication was deprived after February 2010.
Paragraph 69, when the pharmacy orally informed Doe's mother in December 09 that he could no longer receive refills without prior authorization, she contacted DHCF about her problems. Doe continues to be denied refills of the inhalers.
I think that is referring to she continues to be denied refills of the without prior authorization.
Well,
I mean, that's the only way to harm him.
That may be, but he was never given the written explanation.
No, but it didn't result in a deprivation of the drug. What it resulted...
You're saying on the merits, he eventually gets the drug when he gets the authorization, right?
No, I'm saying, well, I'm saying on the basis of what they set forth in the complaint, the only way to harmonize that paragraph with paragraph 65, where they indicate he's consistently receiving that medication, is that what that is running to is the problems that Doe's mother is complaining about, that she has to be very mindful of satisfying these prior authorization problems so that it doesn't result in a deprivation, but she acknowledges that he is receiving that medication consistently since February of 2010. I mean, I think this points out the problem with the complaint in that it's, I think, clear that it's very deliberately and detailed about explaining the problems, but they are not continuing problems. They're problems that have been resolved, making it unlikely that there is real threat
but you agree.
Immediate repetition of the problem.
That's okay. That's okay. This is a motion to dismiss, so we have to interpret the complaint liberally, right?
In view, yes.
Right. Okay. So what we've got here is that you've got a complainant, you've got plaintiffs who have experienced multiple denials without notice. They allege that. They allege that they suffer from chronic problems that will require future prescriptions, right?
Yes.
They, at least if we look at the complaint, we know that the denial rates are high, somewhere between 30% and 50% based on what they discovered through their FOIA request, right?
Yes.
And we know that there's no instructions given to the pharmacies to give notice of either the denial or the opportunity for a hearing. So if we're looking at this complaint, motion to dismiss, we interpret it most favorably to the plaintiff. Why isn't that enough for the court to treat that as an allegation about future injury, that this will happen again?
I think the inference is unreasonable in this case because we have a very highly detailed complaint that identifies five individual plaintiffs with a series of problems, and each of those problems have been resolved by their own allegations set forth in the complaint.
Is that these problems are arising because they aren't getting notice, and they aren't getting notice for their opportunity for hearing. And why can't we infer from the complaint, based on all of their allegations, including their conditions, the fact that we have a high denial rate, and that the agency concedes it doesn't instruct pharmacists to do this, that this is just going to continue? I mean, it's hard for me to imagine who would have standing if these people don't.
Well, Your Honor, I don't want to be repetitive. The reason I would submit that the court should not make that inference here, particularly on the issue of whether or not there's immediate threat, a real and immediate threat of repeated injury,
right,
is that all of the problems which they clearly set forth in their detailed complaint have been resolved. And the procedural right doesn't occur in a vacuum. There needs to be a denial before the right to notice is triggered. The second point I would just like to briefly make, and I know I'm running out of time, and that is that plaintiffs have not also shown that given their own allegations I would submit it's not reasonable to think that it's substantially probable that a lack of notice will cause the delay that's complained of here. The lack of notice may have addressed or may mitigate the injury. It doesn't cause the injury. I think that's another reason for which would deprive the plaintiffs of standing in this case.
Let me take you back to my first question.
Yes.
And maybe what is there a problem? And I realize we're at the standing stage here, and I'm asking a merits question, but I'm just curious why providing this notice through this computer system would be a problem, since it's already required by D.C.'s own statutes.
I think, as I said, there are many, many reasons why there would be a denial.
That's why the statute says they're entitled to notice.
Right.
That's the reason.
That's one of the reasons. The other is just whether or not this is, a temporary delay. Mm-hmm. And that's why I tried to use Mr. Rucker as an example in terms of whether notice, and I know this is going to the merits of the, but in an attempt to answer the question, I think I need to use Mr. Rucker on the merits as an example of whether or not notice is actually required in that case where
isn't it under D.C. law required in all cases?
Yes, when there is a denial.
Right.
And here, I would submit that there was an error in spelling his name or entering the number. He's contemporaneously told that.
Anything else?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Did Mr. Terrace have any time left? Okay, you can have 2 minutes.
I just have a couple.
Including your 30 seconds.
The notice, of course, did not cause the denial of the drugs, but the case is not about the denial of the drugs. It's about the denial of the notice, and the denial of the notice prevents the remediation of the denial of the drugs. That's what the point of notice and a hearing is, to allow somebody to remediate the problem.
Right, and what's your response to his argument that...
Excuse me?
What's your response to his argument that notice was not given, but there was no harm because the problems were corrected?
Well, the people themselves, by various methods, later on got their drug. But the delay itself, of course, is harm. People that need drugs and are delayed in getting them, one person up to a month, that's very substantial harm. But let me go back to my final point is about Lujan. Justice Scalia is very clear. In procedural cases, you don't need injury in fact. The words he uses are concrete interest, and he certainly knew the difference between those two phrases. And in illustrating the difference, he pointed to a procedural case in which there was a denial of a hearing. That, in other words, if you have a concrete interest and there is a denial of procedural rights, like the denial of a hearing, that satisfies what is normally an injury in fact requirement in substantive violations. Also, you do not need to satisfy the imminence requirement. Under Lujan, you have to show a distinct risk, which is obviously a less onerous requirement to satisfy. Here, there certainly was a distinct risk that these people would again have the denial of their drugs, and therefore their procedural rights had been violated, and they had the right to make that argument in federal court. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Case is submitted.